Hello and welcome to this podcast from Polity Books. My name is George Miller, and my guest on this program is Peter Nolan, who's Professor of Chinese Management at the University of Cambridge and a leading international expert on China and the global economy. The Financial Times has said of him, Peter Nolan knows more about Chinese companies and their international competition than anyone else on Earth, including in China. There's currently a great deal of comment in the media about how China is buying up the world. To read some sections of the media, you would think that this is China's sworn mission and one which is already well on its way to completion. Peter Nolan's book sets out to discover if there's any truth in this belief, and proceeds level-headedly to examine the extent to which China has invested in the West, and conversely, the West has invested in China. Who really calls the shots in the key global industries of the 21st century? Who dominates the fields of aviation, finance, technology, even soft drinks? The Chinese or Western multinationals? I met Peter at Jesus College, Cambridge recently and began by asking him about the prevailing discourse about China's alleged designs on the world and why he felt it merited closer examination.
Series of items or articles or published in magazines, journals, newspapers with lurid titles such as When China Buys the World, The Great Hall of China, and there's a very clever allusion to the Great Hall of China. Article after article after article, book after book has been published about China's rise, China's domination of the world, China ruling the world. And the perception of most people, most ordinary people, is that China already rules. China is already the most powerful economy in the world. A recent poll in America, I think 60 or 70%, some enormous number of Americans believe that China is already a bigger economy than America, which is very, very far from the truth. The most important reason for publishing this book is about international relations and the possibility of conflict with China. Recently, John Huntsman, the former ambassador to China, who ought to be responsible, gave an interview while he was standing as Republican candidate in the United States of America. He talked about the various things that the West should do in terms of its relationship with China. He concluded the interview by saying the task of the foreign policy of the West is, quote, to bring China down. And that is not a good foreign policy objective. It's extremely dangerous. And so, there is a wide spectrum of opinion, unfortunately very wide in the US, which is frightened of China's rise, uses it as a weapon to divert people from our own current very severe economic problems. But also, even before the current economic crisis, there was a very strong segment of opinion, which is now, of course, getting radically enforced, which wants to do something to prevent China's rise before it becomes too powerful. At the end of the day, there's always the consequence of military conflict with China, but the blunt reality is that would be very, 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 very dangerous indeed. Everybody knows that. So I can summarize the hostile elements, which are very widespread in Western policy, as being to win the war with China without actually fighting the war. And the best thing to do is destabilize the country and bring it down. And the discourse of China buys the world is at the center of that foreign policy discussion, which I consider to be very dangerous.
But the problem really arises when policy is built on misconception, whether they're willful or inadvertent.
Yes, and the misconceptions about China in this respect are comprehensive and widely believed by almost everybody. So I was stimulated to write the book by that background. All of my friends believe that China already is extraordinarily powerful. They believe China is buying the world. And when you ask them, tell me what China's bought in this country, of course they find it quite difficult to answer the question because they don't know. If I asked you what China's bought?
No, I didn't even know that China bought Volvo and Buffing today.
Okay, Volvo. Yeah, but Volvo, exactly. But Volvo, China was bought by Geely. And Volvo was a company that was entertaining medium-sized automobile company. And Volvo itself, the company, said we can't carry on making money making cars. We should concentrate on trucks and earth-moving and up trucks and other large, similar large equipment. And so they gave up. And so they didn't think they could make money out of Volvo cars. Ford couldn't make money out of Volvo cars. And it was bought by Geely. And whether it turns into a winner for China is debatable. It might do something, but it's going to be very, very hard. But that's it. You know, apart from Volvo cars...
And I don't really attempt to buy a Saab because I drive a Saab.
What have you got?
A 9.3.
Oh, that's not
a Saab. Well, I've had a 900 in the past, but I didn't feel that I'd be able to.
Saab 10 with the Saab 96. You didn't drive a Saab 96. We drove a Saab 96 for years, so I love the Saab. But of course, doping this part, you're absolutely right. And they tried to fail, but then they tried to buy it, but that didn't go through. But that would have been an even more bankrupt and useless company than Volvo. So I asked you, what's trying to bought, and you can't name anything because nobody can, but they haven't bought anything.
I suppose the thing that I was most aware of, apart from manufacturing, was the involvement in infrastructure in the developing world. And that, I guess, the perception there is that they are laying the groundwork for having much greater influence in future.
China is quite a successful constructor of infrastructure in developing countries. Today comes through the reopened King's Cross Station. I don't know how long it took us to build it. I think it took about 5 years to build. If China was building it, it probably would have been built in a year, maybe even 6 months. And China has a very good record of construction in its own country, building roads, railways, airports. For example, if you compare the new airport in Peking, which was built right on time and worked perfectly, and compare it with our attempts to build airports, the contrast is dramatic. China is extremely good, very professional, very capable, competent for building large construction projects. And so developing countries have benefited a great deal from that. And China is very active in doing these kinds of projects, and they work greatly to benefit developing countries. And if you want to ask why Africa's growth rate has improved, versus South America's growth rate has improved, especially in Africa, China's infrastructure construction has made an important contribution to that, as well as, of course, its purchasing of natural resources from Africa. So it's good at that, very capable. That's a fact. It's better at the West, broadly speaking, at building ports, roads and railways.
I mean, you clearly don't share the widespread apprehensions, but do you at least understand where they're coming from, even if they're based on misconceptions and ignorance?
Well, I absolutely understand where they're coming from, and I think it's a tactic terrifying. The most commonly used, apart from China buying the world, the most commonly used concept trying to understand China in a lot of this academic discourse is the Peloponnesian War, the problems that were posed by Sparta and otherwise at Athens. And that idea of the Peloponnesian War scenario, the late coming rising power causing apprehension of existing strong power, is one that is easy to understand, but it's very dangerous. And the task of international relations is to try to enable people better to understand the other element in this equation and to work together to precisely prevent something awful happening. The latest book by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the former head of the National Security Council, National Security Advisor in the United States of America, was very interesting. He's now into his 80s, and he warned us that if we don't engage intelligently with China, the risk of serious conflict, even military conflict, is great, and the number one goal of international relations should be to construct an international relations based on wrong understanding, not alarmist sentiments, in order to avoid, he says, looking back at our own culture in the 20th century, what we did, which was a horror. And nobody before the First World War really thought that this completely irrational thing could happen. Of course it'd be irrational to have conflict with China. It was insane to send our children to go and mash each other, convince each other to pieces in the First World War, but it happened. And his book is very passionate and very powerful and comes from the same impulse that has drove me to write this book. And you can't engage with something unless you really understand what it is. And unfortunately, our economy is in a very difficult situation and remains so for a long period of time ahead. And it's very convenient to scapegoat another entity and scapegoat China, is the easiest thing in the world. And of course, the question I ask myself continuously is about our racial fears. Is there racism underlying this? To what degree? How important a part of the equation is that? And we have to reflect on that.
I mean, I suppose we saw a comparable sentiment of resentment, fear, apprehension underlying xenophobia with the rise of Japan in the 1980s about, taking our jobs and so on and surpassing as a nation that we thought of as have been inferior in economic terms, actually surpassing us. But do you think it's a different sort of phenomenon of China?
I think your analogy is correct, and the sentiments were very well spread indeed. The difference, of course, is that China is much, much, much bigger in terms of population than Japan, and that its eventual size, if it grows at anything remotely close to its present size, will be vastly greater, relatively much more important than Japan ever could have been. There is, of course, a very big difference with Japan, which is Japan had already established an extremely powerful group of many tens of leading high-technology companies, and they're still around, most of them today. China, of course, does not possess that. China has its companies, which are powerful in terms of their market capitalization, are mainly powerful with large revenues, large profits, and large market capitalizations, almost entirely based on the domestic market. They're protected from foreign intervention, they're protected from foreign ownership. Banks have a 20% limit on foreign ownership by an individual bank, 25% in total. And oil companies cannot be acquired by international companies. They can work together outside China, but they can't acquire them inside China. Telecommunication system, telecommunication services are a reserve of China's state-owned companies. So some important strategic sectors in China are protected by the government, and China has restructured them to build, in each case, a very small number of very powerful companies, and they have fast growth, high profits, and big market capitalizations. But they're not high technology companies. The companies that use high technology from the outside world, they don't generate high technology inside. Banks don't make the high information technology that makes them different giant entities. So banks across the whole world operate in the modern world with IBM mainframes, IBM and HP servers, Oracle and SAP software, ATMs by Diebold, NCR, Winkel, Nixdorf, and Intel's inside these key systems. And Chinese banks are no different, same as HSBC, same as JP Morgan. But of course, China has no high technology companies at all in those areas, nobody at all. So the core technologies of information hardware and software are almost exclusively firms based in the high income countries and predominantly American firms. And so these are a very big difference. Whereas Japan had a core of very high technology companies, when people were considering its rise, China today does not have any.
It's a key part of your argument that we shouldn't just be looking at what China is doing. We should also be looking at how the nature of business in Western high-income countries has changed in the last 30 years. What do you think the most significant changes are in looking at the global picture of business?
The question makes me laugh because as you ask the question, I'm thinking about the way in which economics is taught in universities with models of perfect competition, myriads of firms with no names, no brands, that just fight a battle with other nameless firms, so-called perfect competition. And the book which probably most perfectly encapsulates for a modern audience this vision of the nature of a global business driven by myriads of small, perfectly competitive firms is, of course, the book by the American journalist who has a genius for great titles, but the great titles often are not matched by books that are of equal interest in terms of their content. This the book with the title The World is Fat, a very popular book in China. And so the predominant view among Western mainstream economists, which has been taught in universities for at least 100 years, is that the core of competition is small firms fighting each other, and mergers and acquisitions are mostly a waste of time, they mostly fail. When firms become large, they won't stay large for very long. They're managing a diseconomy of scale, it's hard to manage a big firm, and they'll soon collapse. And that vision was beautifully expressed by the Cambridge economist Alfred Marshall when he likened competition to the trees in the forest. In other words, the forest canopy is always of the same height. Trees rise, they get old and die off, and they're replaced by other trees, which are replaced by others in a continuous churn of this fashion. And that's the way most economists, because it's much easier to construct economic models based on that, and make people feel comfortable because it's well small business and people like small business. But the reality, of course, there's another way of looking at the world, and that way was the world, as discussed by Karl Marx, and that was the world where the basic law of economic operation is the law of centralisation of capital. But one of the reasons it's not popular in Western academic institutions is, of course, that Clonmart, as one or two people might be aware, was quite important in the ideology of communism. So it's not a good idea to teach Clonmart, because this means you're teaching students to be communists. Well, that's a very interesting question. But you, as a social scientist, you should look seriously at the logic behind the things that you are criticising. And actually, Karl Marx's insight was quite brilliant, especially as it was constructed in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, before so much of these modern tendencies had become apparent. But there are other economists, people like Alfred Chandler at the Harvard Business School, my own teacher, Edith Penrose, who said the world is really rather different. And we now have a chance to test these two different views of looking at the world. We've had 30 years of liberalisation, Washington consensus. Actually, who's right? Is it the gentleman with the long beard? Is it Karl Marx? Or is it a nice family professor with a three-piece suit, Alfred Marshall, in longer seat? And the answer is, it's just transparently obvious that Marx was right. And nobody wants to talk about it. In fact, people want to talk endlessly about pointless models and games, but they're not looking at what's behind them. They're endlessly studying some little tiny mouse while behind them is a gigantic elephant, and they don't want to look at it. The reality is, it is obvious. Every sector you touch has seen a process of intense industrial consolidation. The market has got bigger, the market has grown at very, very high speed, 10, 20, 30 times bigger than the 1960s or 70s, and the number of key firms has got smaller and smaller and smaller. And the Chinese say, sure, seek the truth from the facts. When I was a child, we had, I think, 15 companies in the world, including three Russian companies, three in this country, a German company, two French companies, three American companies which made large commercial aircraft by the standards at the time. The market has grown immeasurably since then. And what do we get? Two companies, Boeing and Airbus. The automobile industry, there are many tens of firms in the automobile industry today. We have six giant companies which dominate the whole world of automobiles, the same in trucks. And you can say, well, this is very strange because this is high technology. So I would say to people, let's take something low technology. A nice, easy, low technology thing is auditing. Anybody can audit accounts. I've got a very small accountant who does my work. But if you look at the commanding heights of auditing the giant global corporations, which is where most of the money lies, which is four firms. There used to be five, now there are four. There were eight, there became five, now there are four. So the basic, that's Karl Marx. That's the basic law of capital. And then if you think about physical production, something nice and simple, like a soft drink or beer, anybody can make beer, virtually. Anybody can make a soft drink. What have we got today? We have two super, super demand soft drinks firms that control the commanding heights of the global soft drinks industry. And now, basically, two beer companies, four if you include the two slightly less larger companies, but the top two are dominant in this industry in the world, in the simple industry as beer. So obviously, Marx is right. And the story is even more dramatic, because if you look down at what I call the iceberg of industrial competition, underneath the surface, unstudied, by the way, by almost anybody. I've tried to study this ever since, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And most people, even in the industry, don't really know what's going on. So if you take something like, let's take the soft drinks of the beer industry, you've got four giant beer companies, two super giant soft drinks companies. But when you take a simple thing, as let's say two sectors, metal cans and industrial gases. The metal cans, when I started studying this 20 years ago, there were tens of metal can companies. Today, there are just three. And one of these, Rexam, which nobody's ever heard of, but it's a UK-based company. And Rexam is one of these three giant companies built through a sequence of highly successful mergers and acquisitions. Rexam has plants across the world. It produces annually about 60 billion beverage cans. In other words, enough for 10 per person on the planet. And it sells a modest number, 25 billion, to the company with the red stripe, otherwise known as Coca-Cola Company. Now, this is incredible industrial concentration, what I call the cascade effect of pressure pushing down the supply chain. Another very simple business is industrial gases. Sounds very easy, it's very straightforward. That industry is now consolidated to the point where there's three companies, one Guillaume, Linde, American Praxair, one French Air Liquide. And between them, they have plants across the world, and they produce about 80% of the total supply of industrial gases in the world. China, India, Brazil, Britain, France, Germany, across the whole world. They have, of course, small plants, just as there are small plants making metal plants. But they're small plants, they're part of a giant system. And all of the people would say, oh, these big firms, all of them big firms, there are lots of little clusters of small firms around them. Wakey, wakey, as the Billy Cotton Band firm used to say, go and look what's on the label. These are giant firms that are clients across the world. That's the nature of the modern business system, whether it's the soft drinks industry, the automobile industry, or the aircraft industry, any industry you care to name. I can't think of one to which this trend does not apply. That is not inconsistent with billions of people working in small firms, the world of perfect competition, the world of Alfred Marshall. And these are the poor people of the world, the bottom 60 to 70% of the world, the bottom 4 or 5 billion people. They definitely can't afford to drink Coca-Cola. They will never go in a Boeing plane. They will never buy a GM car. And they work in nameless, small, unprotected work without trade unions, with very high rates of damage to their, very high rates of mortality, of harm to themselves. There are probably, in the global mining companies, there are just four big giant mining companies in the world. They probably, between them, employ no more than 400,000 people. The latest development, Rio Tinto in Australia, has giant, completely automatic trucks to move its product, and automatic trains to take it from where the trucks bring them to the track, completely 100% automatic. The numbers employed are falling and falling. Their share of world production and trade is rising and rising. In the mining industry around the world, there are probably 30 million people who work in abominable conditions with picks and shovels, with incredible danger to their health and their families. There is a world of perfect competition, and it's a world of perfect competition for poor people. The world of globalization is highly concentrated.
The relevance of that to your argument about China is that in this very world of great concentration of power of these global firms, it's difficult for China's state-owned champion companies to really to penetrate that world. Even for those structural issues of that, in addition to the ideological and political ones that you alluded to earlier.
Absolutely. We have, when we say China buys the world, and we talk about China's strategy of going out, the so-called Golden Shoe strategy, which was enunciated 4 or 5 years ago, a bit more than that. We have been going out for 100 years, more than 100 years, after we did go out and construct colonies in North America across the world. This country had, whatever we had, 500 million people under our rule by 1940. That's a pretty big deal of Dolce of going out. We went out with poor vengeance. French not quite so good as us, but they went out. And of course, the Americans went out, our ancestors went out and conquered North America, killing directly or indirectly 10, 12, 15 million North American business people, depending on how you measure it. So we've done our going out, that's for sure, since the 16th century, Dolce Gio. Of our own special kinds, usually extraordinarily violent, and we were very reluctant to give up our going out. If you look, for example, at France in the teeth of the independence movement in Vietnam between 1945 and 1954, killed countless Vietnamese who were struggling for independence in a united front. Having been defeated in Vietnam, they went back to Algeria, which they conquered in the 1830s and 1840s with incredible brutality and violence, with lovely little episodes of going out, such as the Enfumation, which is destroying people who took shelter in caves, men, women, and children with smoke, and killing in what is called the Petite Guerre, the Little War, hundreds of people who were trying to fight against French violence in the 1830s and 1840s. And then, 100 years later, when they once again tried to assert their independence after the French were removed from Algeria, and were enlightened, the French people came back from Algeria, from Vietnam, sent to Algeria, and then committed abominable crimes between 1954 and the early 1960s in Algeria. So we have nothing to be proud of over the long term in our going out policy, that's for sure. And in Ghana, we were not very willing to quit the places where we had gone out. And of course, that's our long term record. But since the 1970s, our already powerful global companies became even more global, and we've gone out and hugely built our production systems around the world. South America, India liberalised, China liberalised, former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, all liberalised. And we've built global business systems in the last 30 years, truly spanning the world everywhere, global production systems. If you look at the foreign direct investment stock and its growth since the 1970s, our in the high-income countries, companies account for almost nine-tenths of that growth. Developing countries are nowhere in that growth of international investment and building global production systems. China is nowhere in that process. ourselves up until this point. The future, we can always talk about the future. Who knows about the future? But we have gone out and we have captured the best position in the global aerospace, automobile, beverage, media, marketing, banking, any industry you care to mention. And for China to come into that industry and to try to capture global positions in that industry is very, very hard. Whatever industry you look at, whether it's mining, oil, beverages, automobiles, it is very tough, very, very tough. And not only have we gone out into the developing world in general, but also we have grown very, very fast in China. And this is one of the great challenges for China. In order to modernize, it has needed foreign direct investment. And foreign direct investment has played a central role in China's growth. So China knows it needs it. For example, in its aircraft industry, could China build its own planes from scratch in the 1970s? It tried and it failed. It's just too difficult to just make a leap into producing modern aircraft. And so China today, its air fleet, is entirely composed of Boeing's and Airbus's. What that's meant is that China's air system, China's national airline companies, which we can't buy, are entirely stocked with the best, latest technologies, and it's very safe. Not only the planes, but also the air traffic control systems. We and the Hong Kong countries produce these systems, which means China has built a very safe infrastructure at very high speed, and that's been very important for business and for life in China. If you look at China's banks are modernized at very, very high speed. They have no positions outside China to speak of, but they've provided a huge service to the biggest banks in China for their people, the top four banks, top five banks. But in order to do that, China's government has accepted there is no way to modernize the information technology of their banking system other than to accept that they need to buy key technologies from the leading global companies based in these Americans. So the mainframes are all IBM for the big five banks. The servers, the second core of the banking system are IBM or HP. Their business software packages are either Oracle, which is number one, or SAP, which is number two. If you go and put a card in a machine in China, it would almost certainly be either NCR, Diebold, or Wincom Nixdorf. And inside those will be Intel technology. So in order to modernize its banking system, China has accepted it has no choice. It must accept that it has to buy from the world's leading companies, which are predominantly American. I've just come back from a conference in China, which is on innovation. The National Cloud Development Forum, each year the Chinese government organizes this, since the year 2000. And the theme of this year's conference was innovation and green China. That's great. China must become greener. It won't be green, we won't be green, but it'll become greener. And so the goal of China is to increase energy efficiency and reduce environmental damage, both for China's own sake, but of course, this CO2 is a big international relations issue. So China is trying to do something, not as much as the rest would like, but a lot more than it might do, to try to control the growth of CO2 emissions and increase energy efficiency. So there's a huge market in China for high voltage, direct transmission, direct current, electricity power lines, modern energy-efficient power stations, carbon capture and storage, wind turbine technologies, and in the building industry, new technologies with better glass, better construction materials to make buildings more energy efficient, elevators to make the system power less energy using, industrial appliances, home electrical appliances used in buildings that are more and more energy efficient, transport systems that are more energy efficient, better automobiles, better trains, all these things China hopes to achieve, electricity industry, buildings, appliances, transport systems, and of course fuel systems. But when you think about these areas, who is going to be the suppliers of this huge market? And China has very limited, it has some progress. It has some progress in electricity industry and high voltage transmission systems. It has some progress in high speed trains. But these are very spotty. The reality is the main technologies for making China green today are produced by a small number of giant global companies that are headquartered in our country. So at this meeting, the China Development Forum, I don't know, about 70 global companies are there, all, of course, arguing quite rationally, you need our technologies in order to become green, And so China's efforts to become green, to avoid international conflict, and to help benefit its own people, is producing already a huge market, and the market will get bigger and bigger. For whom? Clearly, our companies, those that are headquartered in our own countries, are the ones that are far and away in the lead in these technologies. One statistic, above all, illustrates this dominance of our firms in innovation, high technology, not least of all in green technologies. And that is the report that was produced each year by the UK government, or at least was 2 years ago. This is called the list of the global 1,000, the top 1,000 companies in the world by R&D expenditure, research and development expenditure. This is the core of the global technical innovation progress. The expenditure 2 years ago was $545 billion by the top 1,000. Well, not much else in the world apart from these 1,000. Governments do something, universities do something, but that's the small part of the picture. Business provides over 3/5 of the funds for total global innovation. Within these 1,000 companies, the top 100 companies account for almost exactly 3/5 of the total. I want to put that. The top 100 companies account for 3/5 of the total. And they are every one of them from the high-income countries. So the first point is, who is right, Marx or Merkel? It's clearly the world of Karl Marx. That is, the core of innovation is a very small number of firms that fight each other tooth and nail, just as Marx said, to achieve technical progress. The second point is, up until this point, they're all, without exception, the headquarters of high-income countries. So when, not just China, but Brazil, Africa, India, other parts of the world, Southeast Asia, want to build their green future, use their the most advanced innovative technologies, the positions are occupied by a very small number of incredibly capable firms that fight each other ferociously, and the firms from developing countries are nowhere. In the G1000, the top 1,000 companies in the world for R&D expenditure, there are less than 40 firms from the developing countries, less than 40 from the developing countries. The BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, have just 37 firms in the G1000. America has, I think, 339. That's to say, that's the world. Of course, we can project 50 years hence and say China will rule the world. We don't know. We have no idea at all. We know what the situation is today, and that is the situation today. And it is a deeply irresponsible for the many commentators who argue China has bought the world, China is buying the world, to ignore these facts and misrepresent them. It is extremely damaging to people in international relations.
Peter, you talk to senior people in China regularly, people who must be aware of the situation as you've described it. So, in conclusion, what would you say they see as being within the realms of the possible?
China's leaders fully understand the challenge that their businesses face. There are innumerable voices outside and inside China that say, why do you bother? Why do you care? What does it matter? Firms are all now global. And there's more truth to that. You know, global companies have a top management team that is not primarily often drawn from the company which they happen to have their headquarters. And it is definitely true, and I wish to emphasize this, that globalization is a big challenge for us as well. The difference is, of course, we are relatively high income, but it is a very big political challenge because our firms are no longer our firms. If you look at the commanding heights of the British economy, for example, we have sold off company after company after company, Pilkington, ICI, Magicians, Midland Bank, Cadbury. So this just goes on and on and on. And now, we are just a small part of the global companies that bought those firms. However, there is also a very powerful group of British companies, including HSBC, WPP, Shell, BP, Vodafone, a very long list of companies that are very, very powerful indeed globally. But just as we are now a small part of companies that are headquartered in Sweden or America or France, so the UK is a very small part of the globally successful British companies, like BAE Systems, like WPP, like HSBC, like BP, like Shell, like Vodafone. So that's a big challenge for our politics, because these companies, Britain doesn't mean all that much to them. And that's a big challenge for our political economy, and one that our leaders do not wish to acknowledge, whether it's Labour Party or the Conservative Party or Liberals, because it's very problematic if the core of our business system is actually doesn't care too much about this country. They are truly global. That makes politics much more difficult. And they do not wish to inform our people of the reality of the global business revolution, which is in that way very challenging to us as well. However, from China's point of view, it's no consolation to China to say, well, these firms actually have become more and more global, and it presents a challenge for England, France, Germany, and the United States of America, that their firms, their new firms, have become global and have less attached to the domestic economy. China believes that as a large country with a large population and a proud history, they believe that they should also have their share of companies which are indigenous to China for the sake of the pride of China's people, and because also there are also some important benefits by having the headquarters of a company in their own country. So China's leaders for the last several years, probably since around 2003-2004, have constructed a policy called Gaiyan Zhouqiuqiu, and they tried to create a group of 70 or 80 large companies which can go out of China and become globally competitive. But up until this point, none of them have done so. Really, with one or two small exceptions. Huawei is very successful in telecommunications equipment, but it's an unusual company. It is not a conventional state-owned company, nor is it an army company, as people sometimes argue. And it has been remarkably successful, but it is the exception that proves the rule. China's oil companies still have a very small international footprint compared with the global giants. China has no automobile companies. China's automobiles are produced by joint ventures in China. Its telecommunications companies remain essentially bound within China. The global giants occupy most of the leading spaces in the global telecommunications industry. China's information technology, hardware and software companies are nowhere in terms of global competition. And if you look at the market in the high-income countries, China's firms have a negligible position. China's exports have a very large share occupied by foreign companies in China. About 55% of China's total exports are produced by foreign firms in China. And China's high technology exports, which are growing very rapidly, over 90% are produced by foreign companies in China. So the reality is we are deeply inside China, but China is nowhere inside us. We are inside each other, French firms in Britain, British firms in France, British firms in America, and vice versa. But in terms of the global business system, we are deeply and very rapidly growing inside China. China has a group of powerful, profitable firms that mainly derive their profits from protected domestic markets and are still majority owned by the state. And Chinese firms are nowhere in terms of their position inside our markets, and nowhere in terms of their investment in business systems inside the high-income countries. So Chinese government would like to change this, is trying to change it, but they know it's a very hard struggle.
Peter Nolan. Is China Buying the World is available now in hardback. You can find out more about it and other new titles from Polity by visiting politybooks.com. That's all for this edition of the Polity Podcast, but I hope you'll join me again soon for another programme. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.